Now Jan Hawken talks with Judy Roth, an activist with Psychologists for Social Responsibility, on her work with Israeli and Palestinian trauma victims.
Welcome to KABU, Judy Roth.
Thank you. It's a privilege to be speaking with you.
Well, yesterday there was a massive Israeli police presence in Jerusalem to protect marchers celebrating Israel's 1967 invasion and subsequent occupation of the Palestinian-dominated eastern half of the city, which Arabs call the Nakba, or the catastrophe. On June 5th, 1967, Israel invaded Palestinian, Egyptian, and Syrian territories at once. 6 days later, it had occupied the Sinai Peninsula, Gaza Strip, West Bank, and Golan Heights. Israel's occupation and annexation of East Jerusalem in 1967 has never been recognized by the international community. Well, Judy, you've been working in Israel and Palestine for a number of years now, including your recent trip. Let's start with the situation in Jerusalem and the psychological toll of the occupation of East Jerusalem. What can you report from your visit?
Well, let me do a zoom out first and say that it's actually an anniversary for me as well. I actually started getting to know East Jerusalem exactly 10 years ago. When it was close to the 40th anniversary, going into the 40th year of the occupation of East Jerusalem and the West Bank and Golan Heights. And I had spent a lot of time in Israel. My mother and father had spent time there after the Holocaust, and I had been an exchange student there. And while I thought I knew Israel and I thought I knew Jerusalem, when I was introduced to what was going on in East Jerusalem, it was like Rome was burning. I could not believe the level of devastation, human rights abuses, and violations, particularly as they were impacting families. And that this is now we're talking, I mean, it's been going on for a very long time. I was getting abreast of this 10 years ago. And I can only say that the situation has gotten worse over the past 10 years, particularly as it affects children.
And that is, much of your work does focus on women and children, families. You know, psychologists, including many leading psychologists from the U.S. and from the psychoanalytic community, or progressive pro-Palestinian, have worked in Palestine and Israel for some time and other conflict zones, often involved in dialogue projects or reconciliation projects. Can you speak a bit about some of the pitfalls of those projects and what you've learned over time about the contributions and the limits of psychologists working in conflict zones?
Sure. So first of all, I have to say that you know, I think most of the projects that I've encountered over time have come from really good places, people wanting to make a difference, people wanting to work towards peace and reconciliation. Where I feel like they get misguided is that this is an ongoing conflict zone with really no end in sight. And so what does it mean to engage dialogue when violations are happening on the ground at the very same time? And it seems to me that the very first step, which is the hardest step, is to see and learn about those violations and psychologists to know how they're impacting the psyche. This is not the only place in the world where racism, oppression, occupation, evacuations, and so forth have, you know, penetrated the soul of a person. But they're ongoing and they're relentless, and there's a lot we can learn about that and then try to disrupt and amplify, I think.
And many of our models of trauma, and certainly the kind of prototype of post-traumatic stress syndrome and therapeutic interventions in general assume that things have settled down enough for people to be able to represent in mind and reflect on what's happened, that there's something overwhelming that now is past enough to work with in a different way. But your work is in the middle of ongoing violence and trauma.
Right. I mean, you know, it was so interesting when I first started learning about it, both on the Palestinian side and on the Israeli side. There were many, many, many people who subscribed to PTSD models, but there was no PTSD. There's no post here. So then the question is, what do you just say, no healing till the occupation is over, which could be who knows when? So what kind of presence can we bring? And again, as outsiders, you know, I subscribe to the thought that you have to be extremely careful that you are, you know, you're available or recruitable only insofar as you're invited in and somebody wants to think together with you or wants you to witness. So, you know, it's a very challenging space in which to stand.
And you use terms like accompaniment and responsible witnessing. It sounds like even the struggle with that language suggests some problems over time in kind of the enormous currency of terms like witnessing that can take on almost a sacral tone. And the question is, who's witnessing what and why? What is the point of that? Are people involved outside the area in some kind of personal quest for meaning? And, you know, the interventions of outsiders have long been suspect in such situations. So it sounds like part of your aim is to be very modest about what you're proposing.
And, you know, only to step in if that is desired. I mean, I had the privilege about 4 years ago of engaging with a human rights activist from Ramallah who was long time studying the impact, Palestinian herself, of the occupation and violence on women's lives. And we went in and interviewed women living at the friction points. That those are the points where Israeli settlers are stationed, and those are very dangerous places. And what was the impact of night raids, and what was the impact of the detention of their children and arrest of children? And we learned a tremendous amount about the kind of anticipatory terror that women are living with, the fear of being inducted into a frontline vortex where, you know, kind of all of their hopes and dreams for a kind of normal life they would have to relinquish. And then they were kind of inducted into something which was a kind of like, you know, what Martin Barrow wrote about, the kind of normal abnormality, you know, where large sweeps of the neighborhood and mapping of the neighborhoods to pick up children was normalized, where the detention of their own kids was normalized. And that's, you know, so was that helpful? Is that helpful witnessing? Did it infuse human rights advocacy? We won't know.
But the witnessing, go ahead.
No, we certainly learned a tremendous amount about the kinds of traumas that, you know, in the way that psychoanalysts talk about, that are seeking to inscribe themselves. These are, Martin Bergman, who's a very famous psychoanalyst, used to say that there's nothing more ferocious than a mother's dream and a mother's claim. And so you would see these very young mothers really freaking out. You know, they were taking pills at night, and there was, you know, praying to Allah because they didn't know what to do about this induction into a life that was really perverse in some ways. And so that's what we wrote about. That's what we talked about. Does it make a difference? Who knows?
And there are responsibilities, moral responsibilities as well as political ones, that accompany these testimonials. And so in that sense, it's not the same as many field research projects. Often field research does carry moral obligations to participants, but these must weigh very heavily on you.
Absolutely. And again, because it's a live, active war zone where there has been no reconciliation process, no accountability, no reparation. You know, I've been involved with the Truth Commission project, and we interviewed this one amazing man. He actually volunteered for the project, and he was in his 60s, and we came to see him. He's a grandfather, and it was clear that he'd become psychically stranded when he began to think about what he had done during his military service and what his father had done and what his children were doing and now what his grandchildren were about to do. And he invited us in, and we talked, and we learned about what he did. And he was involved with nighttime arrests. This is like, you know, 30, 40 years ago. The very thing that I was studying with Palestinians a few years before. And there we were, and I really felt for him. We were building kind of a space for him to step through the looking glass, you know, which is a very painful process when you realize your life has either been wasted or your collective identifications are wrong. And yet at the same time, what did it mean to spend the time with him to talk about perpetrator trauma when the other side is really, it's asymmetrical. It's, you know, that side is, the Palestinian side is really under fire. So those are kind of ethical questions, you know, that are just really hard to handle.
And particularly that knowledge that perpetrators of all sorts bring their own histories and are dehumanized by the scenes of violence and oppression. But how do you both acknowledge that while at the same time the focus has to be on the primary victims?
Right. I mean, you know, it is like the perfect storm of politics, ethics, and psychology all together right there, right? You know, where do you position yourself? And I often take a lot of, I guess, solace or inspiration from some of the people who worked in South Africa and Phumla Madikizela, who wrote A Human Being Died Last Night, you know, where she really sought out to understand the perpetrator and to humanize him and was very aware that we could, you know, it's sort of arbitrary what side we end up on sometimes, right? It's you don't actually always get to choose.
And she took a lot of flack for that, her fascination with him. I think sometimes those projects can be misunderstood as being kind of seduced and fascinated by the powerful people who've been so destructive. But I think there is in many of those projects an attempt to understand these dynamics more deeply, because so many people in the world are not easily cast singularly as victim or perpetrator, but often over time occupy both positions. And so it's important who we cast as irredeemably evil and outside the fold of humanity.
Absolutely. And in Israel-Palestine, you can be a perpetrator and a bystander and a victim all at the same time. You know, that's the irony of this thing. I mean, vis-a-vis the occupation, you might not be, but, you know, that there are many people who are carrying historical traumas with them and a lot of PTSD.
So what do you...
Yeah, go ahead.
What do you, maybe in the minutes we have left, we could talk some about where you take this work to the U.S. and other places in the world. I know you're going to an upcoming conference in Salzburg, dealing with some of these issues. Of course, conferences are places where you speak with other professionals, and I know your work and the work of psychologists for social responsibility go beyond presenting at conferences. What are your hopes for these testimonials as they are distributed and mobilize people in solidarity elsewhere in the world?
So I think they're different pathways, and you have to keep working on the different pathways. Of course, it takes energy, and sometimes I have to ask myself where I'm going to get the energy or other people are going to get the energy, because it's very high burnout work for the people kind of disseminating this information. But I think it's also, I think there's a lot of one-on-one and trying to reach two people who are in key positions to hear, to maybe influence, to speak to, whether they're clergy or people in politics or in lobbies who encourage them to go to the region, to write about the region, or to know about these realities. So I think that's one piece of it. I think another piece is that therapy deals with trauma too, but here you are right up in your face with ongoing trauma. I mean, when I was just now in Palestine, I was in Hebron and met with a family that the night before there was a nighttime arrest. And, you know, you could feel the deadness that comes with trauma, with being in that register of, you know, what Lacan said, the real. And so the question is, how do you get these testimonies out so they can be heard? And there's a lot of work about that. I mean, I think movies help and the kind of work that you do and theater can help and poetry, music. I mean, one really has to think, who do you reach to who can hear this and then amplify it in a way that other people can take it in and then be galvanized too?
Yeah, and there's been quite a bit of work internationally on how helpful it is to get people to talk about something in the midst of their experiencing of it, and many caveats about that can actually be extremely problematic, that people need to be able to repress, in a sense, to shut out of mind part of their experience to continue to function. I think as part of what you must bring as a psychoanalytic activist to this is maybe some comfort with stillness, being present with a lot of intense feeling, and probably anger toward you as an outsider at times, your own impotence, but to be able to kind of tolerate some of those intense feelings and not having to say something often or do anything, but to kind of be another presence that maybe works against the extreme isolation of people in these situations.
Yeah, I think that's really a good point. It's the extreme isolation and it's the extreme reactivity that's going on around them. So the idea of just sitting still and reflecting, and, you know, there's the challenge, as you're saying, about not re-traumatizing, and sometimes in telling a story and the compulsion to tell a story, people do re-traumatize themselves, and sort of how to create a presence. You know, often I circle back with the people I've gotten to meet, or somebody I've been with will circle back so that we're kind of tracking what's going on. And I think the other piece is also, you know, you're not just seeking out how people experience trauma. You're also seeking out how people are living with trauma.
Yeah.
And how they're, you know, and people, I mean, I've been amazed how people are, in the midst of, like, terrible situations, kind of reflexively seek out the humane.
Yeah, and people, you know what I mean? Get cook their meals and have sex and children play and under often really incredible conditions. So just in closing, there's a website that you've been part of called Born Equal, www.bornequal.com. Is that one place people can find out more about the work?
Yes, born-equal.net.
Oh, born-equal.net.
.net, yes.
Okay, well, thanks so much for being with us today, Judith Roth.
Really appreciate it.
Psychologist, activist, and good luck with that conference in Salzburg. Maybe we can get a report on that as well when you're back.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Keep up the good work. Bye.